This is a Collider.com audio interview.
Okay, this is for Josh and for Megan. For Josh, obviously you're working off a script and a graphic novel, but what was it like to create a sort of superhero that you could create from scratch whose reputation didn't precede him? And for Megan, what was it like to get away from those robots?
What robots? Oh, that's a different one. coming from, or at least stemming from, a comic book that has had three lives and it wasn't necessarily very successful, but I loved the idea that it refused to die, so it was a survivalist comic book, but it allowed us to kind of take luxuries and do what we wanted to do as long as we had the blessing of the comic book artists. So, you know, the core of the character is there, but then we kind of go off on all these different tangents. Allowed to. Robot question?
Yeah, the robot question. I mean, I like working on action films, and I like working on movies that are comic book based or that have sort of this theme, because there are things that I watched or I loved when I was a kid, so it wasn't really about getting away from the robots, if that's what you were saying. I enjoyed making both films.
Okay, I guess Jimmy and Andrew are the ones to ask this. You know, obviously there's a lot of contemporary resonances in the script. It's an anti-terrorist movie. Can you talk about bringing modern references in it? And can you each say your names before you speak?
Jimmy. I think, you know, as the Quentin Turnbull thing sort of developed, he started out as a sort of a secessionist kind of a guy. And then we sort of added the dynamite vests, and then as, you know, we continued to develop it, we weren't drawing direct parallels to now, but it's kind of impossible not to, in that he'd kind of be like the first American terrorist, you know. I don't think we really set out to draw tons of lines to exactly what's happening now, but it's kind of difficult because we live in an era of like terrorism and, you know.
Was that in earlier drafts of the script?
Andrew, by the way. That evolved. I mean, it was kind of like, you know, the idea of this ultimate revenge, and how can we, you know, relate to Turnbull in kind of contemporary terms. I do think that we did make a decision once we saw the dynamite vest that this is a guy who's willing to, you know, kind of exact terror, not just on, you know, the Civil War, as bloody as it was, you know, soldiers lined up on either side. And this was a guy who was willing to, you know, destroy institutions and innocent people in order to get, you know, exactly what he wanted. So I think it's topical and makes it a little different than just a regular Civil War / Western film.
This question is for Josh Brolin. I wondered if you could just comment on the challenges of the makeup and what it was like dealing with that on a daily basis and the prosthetic.
A pain in the ass.
He loved it.
Because we didn't really have, and it's not even that we didn't have the money, that we chose to go practical, which, you know, Lon Chaney being one of my heroes and loving the idea of morphing, just, you know, and any opportunity to do that, I embrace. It's kind of like the story that Alec Baldwin told before he did The Edge, which was out in Alaska with the bear, with Anthony Hopkins, when he was sitting in his nice, really warm apartment in New York reading the script saying, I think this could be cool, and then smash cut to being out in the middle of nowhere when it's 40 degrees, you know, below zero, and going, maybe I shouldn't have done this movie. You know, we did 3 hours of makeup a day. It was very tough. There were many different layers. I had a mouthpiece that held my mouth all the way back, and that was attached to the back of my neck, and then we did three more layers on top of that. And then I walked around with half a mustache and half a beard in New Orleans for 3 months. So there was nothing attractive. And
we actually talked him out of going further with the eye, which would have been...
Yeah, we actually had the eye, which is in the comic book, and I put down, and I started to get an infection like within the hour. So that wasn't really... I'm not that dedicated. to be honest with you, I think, you know, it sounds like bullshit, but it's not, is that it lent to the kind of curmudgeon-y feel of the character itself. I was definitely... And I couldn't eat. So we would really, you know, a lot of movies you say I work 14 hours a day, but really you only work six, and you wake, you know, you're in your trailer playing Nintendo the rest of the time. And we actually work 14, 16 hours a day. So I couldn't eat that whole time. So I would stuff myself in the morning and then just drink water throughout the whole day. And it was 100 degrees. And so it was a pain. Would I do it again? Yeah, because it's like having a baby, you know. Now I look at the end result and I go, that's pretty cool. And
Jimmy, my question is, there's a number of animated directors that have done computer animated films that are moving into live action films. So can you talk about being at the forefront of that?
It's a massive learning experience and a big jump and a big change. And I mean, I think it's natural because there's, you know, they go through waves where they bring guys from commercials and then music video guys, and maybe that's just what's happening. But I think, you know, it's... There's just a lot of, those are big, expensive movies, and, you know, managing huge groups of people, and I guess it seems like a natural jump, but it's a tricky, difficult one, but.
For both Jimmy and for Andrew, I want to ask you about the casting of these guys, because it takes a lot to turn a 2D, you know, two-dimensional cartoon character into a full-blooded, you know, on-screen persona. So I'm just wondering, can you talk about the casting of Josh?
90% of the casting for this movie and the great casting choices go to Josh, because Josh kind of was sort of was leading the film in the beginning and brought in his friends, and that's the reason why people like Michael Fassbender and Megan and John Malkovich kind of were in the movie, because you know Josh is friends with them, and we picked all kinds of other people around them, but you know, I think that his friendships with John and stuff to get them involved with the film really helped.
Well, you know what, I can say that we actually did get our first choice. I mean, Josh Brolin was our first choice for Jonah Hex. I mean, coming off of the pretty amazing run that Josh had in, you know, over the last couple of years, I just felt like he was also in the Young Riders, so I just, we tried several times to get Josh Brolin to do the movie. He turned us down a few times. We just wouldn't say no. You know, we just kept going back, and we wore him down.
The tenacious Andrew Lazar,
literally.
We really did.
But once he was there, he probably, you know.
And was the question also about why we cast Megan?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really? Hello.
Wow. Actually, you know, Megan's like, there's a lot of, the role of Lila actually has some depth to it as well. It's not just an action movie. I mean, there's dramatic scenes, and we really felt that there's an edge that, you know, Megan has as an actress, that she could play both tough and, you know, kind of that longing that she wants to get out of her life, or she wants to connect to Jonah, and, you know, we just felt it was a really great match. And I have to say that Josh actually did have a little bit to do with that casting, too. Because we were both, literally, the studio and myself, we were both thinking of Megan. And I think Josh sent me an email saying, I think I have a really good idea who might play Lila. What do you think of Megan Fox? And I said, yeah, that's a really great idea.
You know, it's funny, though, and it kind of sucks, because you go, guys, there wasn't that much thought put into it, you know, and I know what you're all thinking, but there actually was, because however Megan was perceived, I like the idea of giving somebody, even though this is a kind of absurd, ridiculous, fun, escapist film, I like the idea of giving somebody the opportunity, like somebody gave me, in saying, hey, we can go a little further with the acting here, or we can, you know, and Megan was great, you know, there's a lot of, even though we made it fun, we did a lot of different takes where she's crying, where she's not crying, and she had to, you know, there's a somewhat of a dialect there. It's kind of a generalized, you know, bucolic dialect. But when I read, you know, some of these articles that she had done, and as kind of acerbic and rebellious as she could be, I wanted to see, like, how real that was. When you have that kind of fame, 22-year-old, I mean, nobody can handle that kind of fame that fast at 22 years old, and I thought she was handling it really well. So when we met, you know, I just wanted to make sure she was the real deal and a scrapper, and that she could go head-to-head with John, and that she could go and really hold her own. And yeah, there's definitely a truck driver mentality there.
Megan, do you have something to say about that?
No, I think it's wonderful what they're saying, and I appreciate it, and I'm humbled by their comment.
Megan, having done other action movies in the past, what was sort of more challenging, doing the action scenes in this movie or squeezing into that corset every day?
Actually, there was one scene, there was one gunfight scene that stunts had been choreographing for, I think, a couple of weeks, and I showed up and I had, like, you know, minutes to get it down and to rehearse it, and it was really difficult for me to shoot the old style, like the gunslinger guns, because I have tiny little baby hands and they're really large and really heavy, and so just the physicality of actually having to pull that off was really difficult. This was more action heavy for me. It was more intricate, the action in this movie, than in previous movies that I've done.
Yeah, but how was the corset?
I loved the corset. Everyone was sort of, when I showed up for camera tests, everyone was sort of kind of like horror. They thought I was like in pain or I was hurting or that something was wrong with
breathe?
Me. Because it was so, my waist was so small, but I enjoyed it. And I wish they would come back into style.
Were they historically accurate? Is that what women of the day or even women of the night did?
Well, I'm not the person to ask, but I would assume
that totally
he does his research. He, you know, he actually put, you know, all that stuff was, we were like entertainingly accurate with a lot of stuff, like the trains were a few years out and stuff like that, but with the clothes, he'd start in a basis of reality and then move off it a little bit. But yeah, that stuff was pretty typical. Okay, we had a lot of photographic, you know, sort of research and stuff that we did, and it was...
The question is, how did you like the corset?
Yeah.
I'm trying to project it onto her and pawn it off on her, but it really is that true.
Megan, we assume too much by looking at your character, how she got there and everything, but did you build this up in your head as to why, what's her backstory? And it may have been in the comic or not, but did you go somewhere for that for yourself?
Well, Josh and I had a conversation about what their past relationship could have been and why she would be so dedicated and so in love with someone who sort of treated her the way that he did and was not able to love. And we sort of came up with a backstory between the two of us of why, what things that had gone on in the past and why she was so dedicated to him and so loyal and so, you know, hurt for him so badly. So, yes.
And why people like that get together. You know, it's a Beauty and the Beast thing physically, cosmetically. But then I think the parallel and the kinetic connection is because they're both they're equally broken. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And then there's also, I mean, I hate saying this, but I will. There's also an older, younger type of thing, you know.
Daddy.
I don't think that that's not really true, but it might be.
Jimmy, was there ever talk about making this an R-rated feature, and is there sort of a director's cut that we can...
There's definitely, the first version of the movie that we, like a few weeks ago, we got our rating, so a few weeks ago we had an R-rated movie that we had to, you know, trim down. You know, it's a very fine line between, you know, what makes it there. We made the decision to go PG-13 quite a long time ago, you know, before we started shooting, and we all agreed that that was the way to go. So we just had to nip and talk some stuff to you know, the MPAA is, can you have them punch him 3 times instead of 5 times, you know, stuff like that. So there certainly is a version of the movie that has a lot more violence in it, but we never had a lot of blood or anything like that. We just, you know, more people died and there was more punching and beatings and stuff like that.
You build a DVD?
Yeah. I think we'll do that probably.
Like an unrated version?
Probably, I would imagine so.
And I think it belongs on a DVD. I don't think, you know, I was very against them going PG-13 in the beginning. Yeah. And then I was very, very happy, and I think that they made the much better decision by going PG-13 because it's not gratuitous. This movie, when you watch it, you expect, at least when I do, you expect it to be gratuitous. And it's not, and I think that's much more interesting than if it were to be like a grindhouse kind of thing where it's just like out there, you know.
Yeah, it's more interesting to look in Malkovich's eyes when he executes a guy than to go to see the exit wound of stuff coming out of his head. I mean, for me, really, it's more interesting.
Is there potentially a significantly longer version of the film for you?
No, not super long. No, not really.
Do you always?
I mean, we have all those scenes expand, you know, and have more violence and stuff like that. But there's not like, you know, there's definitely deleted scenes that we're going to put out for sure.
there's a catchphrase, hey guys, there's a catchphrase, you know, don't get mad, get even. And, you know, we kind of see this as a driving force behind Jonah, that his relationship to retribution. So I was wondering if Josh and Megan, if you could talk about your own relationship to retribution, that, you know, how that comes from. The motivation of what Jonah has to do.
You mean with you?
I don't know. You start. You don't have an answer?
I don't.
Do you have highlights
question.
In your hair? Oh, nice. I like what you have going on.
Yes. No, I don't. Your own Richard. No. Look, this is how I'll bullshit my way through this answer. Retribution, like, if you go back to these Clint Eastwood movies, if you go back to these Charles Bronson movies, there's something, I'll even go so far, and I said this yesterday quite a few times. The last movie that I saw, the last character that I saw that I actually wanted to be, because he did almost superhuman things, and I just wanted that escape for an hour and a half, was Jackie Chan in Rumble in the Bronx. But Charles Bronson, you know, Clint Eastwood, that whole thing of whatever anger you feel in your life, whatever, you're riding your bike down the street when you're 13 and somebody yells something at you or throws something at you, for some reason or another, and you don't feel the ability to fight back, whatever those little things that happen in your life, you do. It's like the cartoon in the back of the comic book where somebody kicks sand in your face. You want that one moment where you have the perfect thing to say or the perfect punch where you don't have to get in a fight. You can just knock the guy out with one punch and then walk away. This is my version of that. This is my wanting to live that. It's my attempt at other people coming to the movie and saying, Jonah Hex is really cool. He does these things. He's with people like Lila. They're broken. It comes from a dark place, but we find levity in the movie. I want to be that guy for an hour and a half. So I want you to leave. The intention is to leave the movie theater and feel a bit puffed up, but not so much that you go put a cap in somebody's head. White version of saying that.
Well, I can't top that. I'm retribution. I'm all full of candy canes and lollipops. I don't even know. Don't even know what that means.
You kind of top that.
This is finally getting fun.
Josh, and Megan, I think back in those days, they had guns and knives as their favorite gear. They would just collect that. Is there anything that you guys like to collect now that's...
Just adult toys, stuff like that. Next question.
Next question.
I don't collect things. No, I'm sorry.
Or a computer, any gear that you have.
Yeah, I love electronics. I mean, I have lots of computers and iPhones, iPads, those sort of things.
Josh, you play characters who have been completely fictionalized and characters who have been based on real people. Does this kind of fall in that kind of middle ground between them? Because although it's a fictional character, there's still a big history there that people know about. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's nice to be able to springboard from a place that, even though it's not real, it's real for me. You know, once you look at the comic book and you say, okay, I have a sketch here. You know, I've said before that a lot of times I'll do a movie and I'll go to my son and he'll sketch out the character. I'll explain to him. I won't have him read the script or anything sometimes. But I'll say, look, this is how I see this character and this is kind of ambiance of the story and all that. And he'll sit there and he'll sketch stuff out. And sometimes I can use it and sometimes I can't. Like Grindhouse, I used it. I told him the character. He made the character really fat. And I was like, fuck. I was used to springboarding from that kind of a place. So this was great for me. And yeah, I mean, look, you know, as fun as it is, as dark as it stems from, you know, it's good to have people in mind of like, oh, this kind of reminds me of that. Or even if I use characters like actors, you know, whether it be Robert Mitchum or whoever, and then say, okay, if I watch a lot of his movies, is there one little gem that I can steal from that and kind of extrapolate on that? But does that answer your question?
Two questions. First, Megan,
Josh said it's been a crazy few years for you. How have you handled everything and not gone insane? And then for Josh, what's your favorite John Malkovich moment on the movie?
I don't know. I mean, I think that I've maintained the same relationships that I've had before this happened to me, and I've kept people close to me that I love, that I respect, and that have looked out for me and take care of me. And you know, I sort of distanced myself from the Hollywood crowd. I don't really go out and socialize that way. I'm sort of very, oddly, you wouldn't think it, but I'm very domestic, and I think that keeps me sane. Just my personal relationships have kept me grounded.
That John Malkovich moment.
Oh. We were doing you guys have seen the movie, I would imagine. Okay, so we were doing the clay fight sequence, me and John. This was fairly early on in the movie, and we finished a take that was fairly violent. And John, you know, the great thing about John is that he's so in character, but he doesn't stay in character. So he'll be like, you know, we'll finish a take and we'll be looking at each other like this, and we'll have this look on our face, and we'll be yelling, "Gah!" You know, and then they go cut, and he goes, "So, when are you doing the Woody film?" there was one take that we did, and John said, "Josh, can you come here for a second?" And I said, "Yeah, John." I said, "What's up?" And he said, "Can you pull my finger?" And I said, "Seriously?" And he said, "Yeah, just grab my finger and just pull it." And I pulled his finger and I heard a crack. And I go, "Oh, fuck, man, are you all right?" And he goes, "Yeah, I think you broke it, but I'm fine." That's my best John Malkovich.
Instrumental in having the producers consider you for the role. He said that he wanted to know if you were as rebellious as he had read about you, and then he finished off by saying, and having that much fame at 22, no one should have that kind of fame. When you hear that, hey, are you that rebellious in hindsight of saying, I'm actually surprisingly domestic? That are there actually two things going on out there? And also, what's the deal with being 22 and having all this fame?
Well, I'm 24 now. This kind of fame, you have to be the people who are famous and make it to this level of fame for whatever reason, whether it's deserved or not, you have to be a strong person to survive it, because it is very difficult to be under the microscope every moment of every day, and everything that leaves your mouth becomes this sensationalized news story, no matter what your intentions were when you first said it. So it becomes overwhelming. But am I that rebellious? I mean, I think there are many sides to me and to who I am, my personality, and I think the only thing that is rebellious about me is that I sort of don't really have a lot of fears as far as this industry is concerned, and I'll do things that maybe other people would be afraid to do or afraid to say. But in my personal life, I'm actually very responsible with my personal relationships and things like that.
Where does the strength come from?
I have no idea. I don't know.
You've always been that way.
I have always been that way.
Yeah, and rebellion, just to be clear, rebellion can mean, you know, holding on to some of your own integrity, of not playing into the idea of this sensationalizing of whatever, you know. I mean, we all have our moments, you know, and that's your guys' job is to take those moments and what is it called? Turgid, you know what I mean? Turgidity. It's gaseous, make it big. And it's bigger than the person is. So once you start believing your own press, you know, that's when it gets, you know, really sad. But yeah, that's part of the rebellion, and I responded because she was still her. She was still very grounded. She was very gravelly.
Okay. Thank you.
A lot of women in Hollywood are beginning to develop their own projects and form production companies. Mm-hmm. Do you see directing and producing in your future?
I'm definitely not directing. I mean, I have absolutely no skill set that would suggest that I would be able to do something like that. But possibly producing, I guess, at some point, if I were able to, I would like to get into that, sure.
Hi, this is a quick question for Josh. I was wondering if you could address some of the buzz in the trades about you perhaps doing another comic book adaptation, the third Men in Black film, where apparently you would play the younger Tony Lee Jones. Is there any accuracy to those reports? Or?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, next question.
I was just going to ask both Megan and Josh, what else is coming up? You had the Woody Allen movie open at Cannes, and you know, future projects. And also for Megan, when you get a character that's described as a hooker with a heart of gold, basically, you know, what do you say to yourself about making this sort of cliche or stereotypical character something real and convincing? Which,
well, I mean,
you did.
Hooker with a Heart of Gold was not in the character breakdown when I got it, but I felt like it was an amazing opportunity for me to be involved in a project with Josh and with John Malkovich and with Fassbender, with all these incredible actors who were coming in to make this movie, and I just wanted to be a part of it any way that I could. And I don't feel, I mean, I don't really feel like she's that stereotypical. I mean, I perhaps, like, you're responding to the fact that I'm playing the character that sort of makes it stereotypical, but it's something completely different than anything I've done, and no one can accuse me of doing the same thing twice, which I'm proud of that. And there was a second part of that question for me, I don't remember.
Upcoming project.
I have a movie with Mickey Rourke, hopefully coming out this fall, called Passion Play, which I was really excited to work on. It's an independent right now, and I'm really proud of that, and I had an amazing experience making that movie.
What's it about?
It's sort of a modern film noir, and Mickey's character is a trumpet player who's sort of down on his luck. He was a heroin addict, and he comes across my character, who is part of a traveling freak show. She has bird wings that sprouted out of her back when she went through puberty. And it's sort of this very bizarre, strange relationship that they have, and it follows them, and it's, you know, it's very tragic, and so on and so forth.
Wow.
Megan, there's a
Inside
Joke for fans.
Wait, yeah, Josh had a...
About what you've got coming up? You've got the Woody next?
I got a Woody next. I got Chubby after that. And I have a Half Mast after that. And then after that, I'm just going to relax and be flaccid. Thank you so much for that, by the way. I got Woody's movie that was in Cannes. I got Oliver's movie, Wall Street, that was in Cannes, which was really, that was something. That was very special to have those two movies in Cannes. We got this coming out next week. We got True Grit coming out Christmas. Men in Black, if it all works out, is going to happen. I just sold something to Warner Brothers that I'll direct probably next year. And a couple of other projects that are really, really good that I can't talk about, but I'm really, really excited about it.
Megan, there's an inside joke about your character.
Pitts and Joe.
Where are you,
oh,
by the
oh,
way?
Here.
I can't. Okay.
There's an inside joke about your character that reveals she is a character from the comics. Would you be interested, this is a big hit, reprising the role for your own film?
Of course. I mean, if that was an opportunity that was presented to me, absolutely. I would love that.
Hi, Maureen. When you're dealing with an adaptation that already has a fan base, are you pretty confident about taking liberties with the character, with the story, with the action, or did you just want to make it your own?
Well, Josh brought that up. I mean, one of the things about Joe Hex is the fan base is, unfortunately, you know, it's not Superman. You know what I mean? So a lot of people don't have a pre-awareness of Jonah Hex. And like Josh said, you know, we are friends with Jimmy and Justin and the guys that do the modern versions of Hex. And Hex has been done, Hex has gone into the future. And there's like a Road Warrior version of Jonah Hex. So there is an opportunity to play a little bit more with
with the story, because there's different versions of how Jonah Hex, there's different like origin stories for Jonah Hex. So there's not as many rules, hard and fast rules with like the origin story of Batman or like or Superman or something like that. So I think we had a little lot more leeway. But we are, you know, I am a fan of the comic and have been reading it for a long time. And love the fact that Justin and Jimmy continue to do it with different artists and stuff. So I think, I don't, and, you know, Josh, I don't think was as much of a fan, but read it, or wasn't a fan before, but read it. And I think we had a lot of leeway, you know.
Josh and Megan, do you feel like you have to take liberty, or you want to take liberties, or you want to just make it your own?
Well, I feel like it's impossible to really please, and I love them, but it's impossible to please the hardcore comic book fans, because they'll never be happy no matter what you do. I mean, I go on, like, because I'm a Lord of the Rings fan, and I'll go on the forums, and they complain about, like, that Frodo is eating the Lambis bread outside of Mordor instead of the Mines of Moria, and they get really mad, and Peter Jackson and company won, like, you know, 30-something Oscars for that movie. So you can't focus completely on pleasing them, because you'll never win, and then you're excluding, like, a whole other world of people who weren't aware of the comic in the first place. So I think you have to take some sort of liberties to make it into a live-action film, or it wouldn't work.
And I mean, a lot of people talked about the amount of blood. That was brilliant, by the way. A lot of people talked about, like, it's got to be bloody and crazy. Really, there's only a few versions of the modern, you know, there's an image run that's, like, really, really violent. But if you go back to the Albano stuff, that's pretty PG-13 stuff. I mean, it's more Jonah in the Old West, and then there's like some supernatural stuff, and you know, so it kind of goes all over the place.
As one of the few people who apparently already was a fan of Jonah Hex,
I am too.
Kind of, at least the current run, he didn't really seem to have any supernatural powers or something, so I'd like to talk about where the speaking to the dead power sort of developed in the process of scriptwriting or coming up with it.
You know,
I really liked how it was done, though.
It came up later, but there, you know, there are sort of some more supernatural versions of Jonah. You know, with his history with the Indians and whether or not he grew up in a tribe or not, and whether or not his father traded him to the Indians, and whether or not there's medicine men involved. So, like, there was a pocket of the, you know, some of the more middle areas of the comic that actually had some supernatural stuff in it, and that did develop later on in the process.
I also want to just ask you about casting Jeffrey Dean Morgan and Tom Wopat.
Wow.
Who was Tom Wopat in the movie?
Tom Wopat, it was Royal Slocum.
He's the guy in the fighting ring, right?
Yeah, yes. He's the guy Josh throws in the fighting ring, yeah. We actually read Tom Wopat in New York, and we didn't even know it was Tom Wopat. We didn't know. It's like, is that one of the Duke boys? We didn't know that. We had no idea. He just came in and read for us, and I both watched the show when we were
originally
kids.
He was described as kind of like a peg-legged guy, and he wasn't really formidable. And when Tom came in and read it, it was like, wow, Slocum, if he's dangerous and is like really formidable guy, that, you know, really creates a whole other dimension to the scene. So we actually...
We didn't know it was Tom Wopat until they told us after. I was like, oh my god, that's... Wow, because he's got a successful Broadway thing going on, you know?
Sondheim on Sondheim.
We read him in New York, and we didn't really even realize.
Now, did Cillian Murphy do a cameo, or was that just my eyes playing a trick?
That's your eyes playing a trick.
Okay.
I will.
Oh.
Jeffrey Dean Morgan is a friend of the court. You know, he's a friend of Warner Brothers. He's done a bunch of movies there, and we wanted him. You know, we tried to get somebody that had some gravitas that could go up against Josh, and it's actually one of my favorite scenes in the film.
Came
so we asked him to do us a favor, and he did it.
Was that for free?
Pretty much. I mean, yeah, pretty much. But you know, it's like when you come in and just do a small part like that. It's obviously. Even though it's an interesting role, it's like, you know, Jeffrey Dean is a really respected actor. So it was, you know, I could have cast him as Jonah Hex.
Jonah
Hex.
There were reports of fairly extensive reshoots and that Francis Lawrence came in to help to some degree. Can you guys clarify what went on with that?
Well,
yeah, I mean, look, there's a difference between reshoots and additional shoots. And there's always a perception of, oh, is there a problem? First of all, who cares? because the end result is all that matters. And the one thing is that when we saw the initial cut, the base cut, we go, oh, wow, there's a lot more humor than we thought here. So maybe it's not as dark and, you know, gritty throughout the whole thing. Maybe we can base that, you know, we can base the movie as dark, and then we can get and find some kind of different colors of levity and all that.
Total shift.
So it was more about enhancing what already was. I think that we missed some things during additional shooting that we didn't realize, because tonally there's no model for this. There's no base for this. It's like three different genres in one. So you go, oh, is it a spaghetti western? Well, no, not really. Is it a supernatural movie? No, not really. Is it an action movie? No, not really. But there's elements of all those things. So it was kind of like plowing out, you know, a completely new genre road and saying, okay, now we know what we have. Now how can we extrapolate on that? How can we?
And also the studio, we realized we really did want to come out in the summer. You know, we made the movie for a fairly modest price, and there was...
We're from September, you know, to June, you know.
We recognized the opportunity to make a couple things, create a couple new, bigger set pieces. It's kind of pretty standard fare. So we're allowed to make the movie kind of a little bit bigger. And open up the scope a little bit.
Yeah, so they moved our date from September to June, gave us the resources to go and put, you know, bigger, crazier end on it and stuff. You know?
Well, but was Francis Lawrence
involved? Francis came in as a consultant and came in and helped us out. He's a friend of the family. He's a friend of, you know, Andrew and Akiva and us, and it was a big help.
And also somebody who knows scope. I mean, Francis is that is the pinnacle of scope, you know, what he's done. So he knew how to... Just that was very important to us when we realized what we had and kind of the whole color palette of the whole thing. It's like, wow, this could seem much, much bigger than it is for the budget that we used or had.
We didn't start off with a budget for a super weapon and all kinds of stuff like that. So he was a good help.
We did this movie for $6,000.
Okay, we've got the last question right here in the front.
Oh.
My question for Josh, this film, your character is kind of big friend with Crow.
With who?
Crow.
Uh-huh.
And hoes and dog. And actually, in my reading...
This is what I heard you say. Crows, hoes, and dogs.
That's what I heard too.
You should just end the press conference there, don't you think? Yeah, don't you think? I don't think you need an answer to that. I think you can write a whole article just on that moment.
Okay, Josh Brolin's the best. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you. I'll talk to you afterwards. I'll talk to you.
I'm very competitive, I think.
Right?
Sorry, we have to go. I'm sorry.
You know how excited your fans will be to hear you talk about Lord of the Rings like that?
Over here.
Thank you.
Sorry, guys. Is this yours?
How are you? I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I am going to do something in a few minutes.
Who he is, and the fact that he spends so much time alone, and I know this personally, having grown up on a ranch, you start to actually, the relationship with animals starts to become much more intense than relationship with humans. So I think that that's a very natural thing, especially in Westerns. There's always been that thing of the guy talking to his horse or a guy who has a dog, you know, Western-type characters. The crows are more symbolism, you know, the omen, more of this purgatory life that he leads. I think the crows always represent something that's fairly, purgatorial, you know, something a little dark. And the fact that they lead him, which I think is really interesting too. They may lead him to chaos, or they may lead him to a rogue act. Does that make sense?
I'm sorry, Josh has got to get going.
Okay.
So you just did the 25th anniversary of Goonies. What was that like?
I didn't do it. It just came out.
Did you guys go back to the set?
No. No. None of that happened.
I have a quick question. What's this project you're going to direct?
Pitts and Joe. It's a play that I did a long time ago that we're adapting, that we're actually, and I'm going to bring in another writer soon. I did an adaptation, bring in another writer to try and really kind of get it out of the claustrophobic feel that it has right now. And then we'll see.
And what's the other comic book character you're considering?
I'm not.
No. Preacher, maybe?